You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Kia ora, Alan. We're joined live in studio once again. We've got some exciting stuff coming up.
Indeed.
How are you doing?
Well, it's day two of the semester, so, you know, it's all happening. And the whole reason that we had to change to Tuesday, folks, is because Marcus and I both had classes on Wednesday at noon, so that wasn't very well organised, was it?
In case you're forgotten, they're actually teachers, so this is unfortunately not their day job. So
only for 24 weeks of the year, folks.
That's all right. That's a better schedule than most other jobs, and we can...
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, don't worry. I'm not complaining. It's a great job.
No, that is good to know. So the first topic for this week is a bit of a relevant one, obviously. Mm-hmm. Chemical warfare and chemical weapons.
Yep.
So you've written something for the paper a couple of years ago, and this was about chemical warfare and the differences between that and regular guns and why... Why is one accepted widely and one isn't?
Yeah, exactly. And this is still a question that I struggle to get my head around. So obviously with the current world events, and obviously I express my complete and utter distaste for Putin and his hench persons and any apologists and stuff like that. But I thought I'd just give a brief history of chemical warfare, because doubtless that's going to rear its ugly head at some stage in the not-too-distant future, as it seems to do with every conflict. One side will accuse the other, and there you go. So chemical weapons or chemical warfare was first documented historically in around about 9th century China, and it spread its way westwards along the Silk Road. And ended up in Europe. And one of the major constituents that was required for this chemical warfare was a thing called sodium nitrate, or as it was called in the books of the time, Chinese snow.
Wow.
And the reason that it all sort of initiated, I guess, in China was because they had lots of this stuff, okay, and they could sort of dig it out of the ground. So you get to Europe in around about the 14th century, and chemical warfare gets there, and then all of a sudden you don't have to have hand-to-hand fighting anymore. You can start inflicting casualties on your enemies at a distance.
Because it is quite effective, eh? It would really incapacitate whoever you're trying to destroy, really.
Absolutely. It was a complete and total and utter sea change in warfare. Mm. And that has persisted all the way up until the 21st century. Both World War One and World War Two, there was extensive use of chemical warfare, chemical weapons, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Syria, etc., etc. And the one thing that's in common with all of these conflicts and the chemical weapons that were used in this is a chemical reaction called oxidation. And what this involves is turning a solid into a gas really, really, really rapidly. And if you do that, what you get is an explosion.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Now, and this is chemical warfare. So anything that involves bombs or projectiles or missiles or howitzers or anything like that, that is chemical warfare, because it is causing a projectile to fly at great speed towards your enemies. And now you're probably all thinking, well, no, that's not chemical warfare. Chemical warfare is all to do with these nasty poison gases and things like that that you drop on your enemies and stuff like that. Well, maybe it is, but guns and bombs and everything like that are just as much chemical weapons as chlorine gas or nerve gas or anything like that, in my view. And so this is what I can't understand, is that we have this Geneva Convention which says, no, you're not allowed to use chemical weapons. So, you know, sarin and tabun and all of these nerve agents, or just chlorine gas or phosgene or whatever, they're all terrible, terrible weapons. And the world, as soon as there's any sort of thing about chemical weapons, the world gets on its moral high horse and says, no, we can't have this, we can't have this. Mm-hmm. But where's the outrage about guns and bombs and explosives and stuff like that?
So in your view, you've kind of... It's going towards a more grey area of what's considered chemical weaponry.
Yeah, well, they're all a product of chemistry, basically.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, because I'm a chemist, but, you know, people have put lots of energy and time and money and everything into developing these weapons. And, you know, what's the difference? Who suffers the more pain? Somebody who gets, you know, hit by flying shrapnel, or somebody who's getting choked by chlorine gas?
It's really ultimately the same effect.
Exactly it is. Exactly. And I'm sorry, but we should be outraged by any sort of weaponry. And, you know, I do get kind of quite upset about all of this. And, yeah, I'm hoping that this doesn't rear its ugly head and that sanity prevails in the next days, weeks, whatever, but I'm not exactly betting against it. So we can only hope. And, you know, really, really, really feel for those poor people in Ukraine at the moment.
Yeah, and I guess the threat of nuclear escalation is quite pressing at the moment.
Yep, absolutely.
Which is incidentally related to this next topic, which is today. I don't know how many years to the day, but this is when radioactivity was discovered.
Okay, 1896, so that would be, add four, it would be 125 years, I guess.
Wow.
Oh, there we go. That's worth talking about.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
So, radioactivity. It's only been known for 125 years. Today, in fact, the 1st of March, 1896, was when radioactivity was discovered. And it was discovered by a French scientist by the name of Henri Becquerel. And he was very, very interested in a thing called phosphorescence. Now, I'm sure that many of you are familiar with sort of glow-in-the-dark stuff. So you shine a light on something, then turn all the lights off and it remains glowing in the dark. I hear it's very popular at raves. And,
No,
I just hear, you know. So all your glow sticks, all of that stuff, you know, that's all phosphorescence. And so way back at this time, Becquerel was very, very interested in phosphorescence. He was trying to figure out how it all worked.
Right.
And in 1895, so that was a year prior to this big discovery, X-rays were discovered by a German guy called Röntgen. And so Becquerel was very, very interested in this, and he was thinking, oh, okay, maybe this whole phosphorescence, this glow-in-the-dark thing, is all to do with X-rays, and maybe these things are giving off X-rays. And so one of the things that he knew was that uranium, so compounds of uranium, were known to be phosphorescent. So you shine light on it and, you know, they end up glowing in the dark. And so what he did was he said, right, let's test this. Let's see if it's giving off X-rays. So what he did was he got a photographic plate. Now, for those of you who remember analog photography as opposed to digital photography, you had to take your film along to the chemist to get developed and all of that sort of stuff. And that was all a big chemical process. But so there was photographic plates which were sensitive to light and radiation. And he left a uranium salt on the photographic plate. So he had a photographic plate, wrapped it up in black paper so no light could get in there, put a uranium salt on there, and then put it out in the sun.
Wow, okay.
And he was thinking, okay, so the sunlight's going to get this uranium thing to give off these funny rays, and I should see it on the photographic plate. And sure enough, you did. You get a lovely picture on the photographic plate of these crystals. Or if you put a little coin or something between the crystals and the photographic plate, you get an image of the coin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But only if you put it out in the sun. Okay. Now, the weather in late February of 1896 in Paris was a bit shit, okay? So there wasn't any sun.
Right, okay.
And so what he did, he thought, oh, no, bugger it, I won't do it today. So he left this wrapped-up photographic plate with the crystals on it in his drawer over the weekend.
Just left it, okay? In the dark.
Right, in the dark. That's the important thing.
Okay.
He came back on the Monday, and for some reason he decided to develop the plate. Because from his hypothesis, nothing should have happened.
Why not, right?
But he developed the plate, and then he saw the image, this perfect image. And he said, oh, sheesh, the sun isn't required. And that was because it was radioactivity. It wasn't X-rays. And he later did further experiments and proved that these rays that were given out by the uranium salts were not X-rays. They were actually radioactivity. And good old Ernest Rutherford came along later on, and he explained what was going on with radioactivity, and he ended up getting the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1908, and Becquerel got the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1903, along with the Curies, who did a lot of work on radioactivity as well. So it's kind of cool to think that, you know, such a fundamental physical process as radioactivity has only been known since 1896.
And so, discovered by accident.
1st apparently. Of March and a completely accidental discovery, yeah. So one of those great scientific accidents, yeah.
Hmm. Anyone who's out there currently doing science and is a bit disappointed in how their experiments turned out, maybe you could win a Nobel Prize in several decades or so.
Well, there's been a few Nobel Prizes that have come for complete accidents, definitely. Oh, yeah, you could write a book. Yeah. Good. Oh, there's an idea.
Maybe I'll try it now. And our final one today, which is on a nice, lighter note, yes. Which is always nice.
Yes.
People get to work with dogs all day, and it turns out that people have been researching dogs and finding that they can actually mourn their companions, which is really sweet.
Yeah. So as the title of the paper was, dogs are deeply affected by the loss of their canine companions.
Aww.
I know. So how did this study come about? So it's just been published in a journal called Scientific Reports. And so there's a whole bunch of folk in Europe and Canada. And what they did was that they interviewed 426 Italian dog owners who owned at least two dogs, one of whom died at some stage while the other one remained alive. And they basically came up with a whole bunch of questions for these dog owners saying, right, do you notice anything different in the behaviour of your dogs since its companion had passed away? And there was a very, very sort of positive response to this, and 86% of the owners reported, yes, that they did see some change in the remaining dog's wow. habits over time. And so amongst these were things like they wanted more attention, they reduced playfulness, which I guess you can sort of rationalise, reduced overall activity, more sleep, more fearful, eating less. They're whining more, they're barking more. And so, you know, this can fairly obviously be put down to the fact that, that they don't have their friend anymore to, you know, play with and socialise with and all of that.
So was this kind of like a crossbreed experiment? Like were they similarities noted in all breeds of dogs?
Yeah, so they were just random breeds of dogs. What they did find that also, surprisingly, the length of time that the two dogs have been together didn't seem to make a hell of a lot of difference. So whether it was a short time or a long time,
they just missed them,
which is really kind of interesting. And the final thing also was that the owner's behaviour following the loss of the dog also seemed to influence what the actual other dog would do as well. So if the owner was particularly affected by the loss of the dog, then also the other dogs seem to be as well.
Because dogs kind of have a very strong attachment to their
owners. Oh, yes, indeed. And obviously they have very, very strong attachment to their companions as well.
Wow.
As I see every time the neighbour's dog gets taken for a walk by the dog walker, you know, there's about 20 dogs in the van and this dog just cannot wait to get into the back of that van and go for a walk on the beach sort of thing. So.
Well, that's really sweet. And I'd love to imagine being in that lab and getting to meet all these dogs. I'd rather do that than a survey because you can actually, like, just pet the dogs. And
it's a pretty cool job. You know, you get to work with dogs and stuff like that. So
no, definitely good. Some good stuff out there in science, isn't there? But that's all we have for Dear Science again this week. Thank you very much for joining us, Alan.
Not a problem. Always a pleasure.
Amazing. Okay, well, I'll let you go then. Have a great day.
Okay, see ya.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Thank you.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.